Welcome to Open Book on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Carrie Perloff, who's the artistic director of American Conservatory Theater, ACT, in San Francisco. American Conservatory Theater has been around since 1965. Carrie Perloff is now in her 17th year as the director of ACT since 1992. ACT puts on eight productions next year.
On the main stage and a lot around that. Yeah.
A lot around that, which we'll talk about too, because most people just know about the main stage.
Right.
The next production is War Music, which is the world premiere of a play based on a book by Christopher Logue, adapted and directed by Lillian Grogue. Carrie Perloff, before we get into ACT's upcoming season and other questions about theater in the Bay Area, let me start by asking you, I said, how you doing? You said, I have to get back for tech. Now, you're the artistic director, but there's someone else who's the director.
Right.
What does that mean, that you have to get back there for tech?
Well, it's a great question. It's not that I sit in every minute of everybody else's tech rehearsal, but two things with this one. First of all, it's so exciting. It's such an epic, extraordinary production that you sort of want to be there and watch it unfold. It's a piece that was created for our core company by Lillian Grogue, based on this incredible version of the Iliad. So it has an enormous amount of choreography and original music and very complicated design. And so this is one where it really helps to have a producing eye be there with the director in case there are things that come up that she needs and decisions that need to be made, or just to help move the whole thing forward. That's part of the producing process.
So this is the week that the actual previews start then?
Uh-huh. Every day is an incredible journey. The tech process is where where it gets lit, where all the music gets introduced, everything. And so it's not done until you've actually walked through the entire play with the company on stage with all of the technical stuff. And then it's not done until you've done it with an audience. You learn a lot from your audience.
Do you think that it's sometimes a mistake? I mean, it has to be done because reviewers have to be there. For reviewers to see a preview or opening night?
They don't. Our press comes on opening night.
Do you think it's always ready?
You know, every play is different. And actually, I always feel for the critics because I don't know what the word ready means. What's brilliant about live theater is it's different every night. Certainly, you hope it's technically ready. But the performances evolve. And actually, it's a really good question that you ask because I think it's sad that critics never get to see a play into its run where it's really matured and settled and the performances are much richer. But that's the life of a critic.
Carrie Perloff, let's talk a little about ACT. You came in 1992, and at that point, ACT had gone through some really, really tough times. Geary Theater was closed. It was in debt. How did you manage to pull it out of debt? How did you manage to do that?
It has been a totally wild ride, and in a way, I'm sort of grateful for the crucible that we went through because even though these times are so perilous, I feel like we've been there before in some ways at ACT. I definitely inherited a ruin. And I don't know if you know this, but I trained to be an archaeologist. So this was very comfortable to me on one level, this destroyed theater. But we had to very quickly reimagine everything. And sometimes that is a great thing. When something is wiped out, you have to start clean and ask things like, why should this theater exist? Who is its constituency? What is its aesthetic? What is its history? Why does it have a school? It's a critical thing about ACT that we're a major school. Why? So we had to ask all of those things. And rather than walking into a place with a lot of given assumptions, I just tore it apart. It had to be. It was already torn apart.
When you say you tore it apart, what do you mean?
I assumed that nothing was a given and just started clean. I really asked, should we have an MFA program? When I interviewed Melissa Smith, who's now running the school, we did an interview for who was going to now run the school. One of the things I asked is, why should there be an MFA program at ACT? And Melissa said, if it's not one of the top five programs in the country and it doesn't really fuel your main stage, get rid of it. And that's been her mandate, and she's done it. And it's an extraordinary program that does fuel our main stage, but that was a good thing to ask. It was like that across the board. I had to ask all those questions, and at the same time, we had to raise $28 million and rebuild the Geary. And that meant getting out there in the trenches, and boy, did I get to know this community and this funding community quickly. I had to, because I had to go out there and make the case over and over and over again.
Well, what happens when that begins to interfere with your own work as a creative person?
Listen, this is life in America as an artist. You know, anybody who ever chose to be an artist in this country and thought it meant being in the studio all day has another thing coming, and they should move to, I don't know where, who subsidizes theater anymore. But not here. I mean, this is part of the muscle of being an American theater artist is first you have to create the conditions into which you make the art, and then you have to make the art. So it means your left brain is doing logistical things all the time, and you protect that piece of your right brain that you hope is fertile and creative. And then what I do is create a situation that when I go into the room to rehearse, when I'm directing a play, my team knows that that is sacred time, and they leave me alone. But the rest of the time, you're in the trenches all the time. And you do an 8-hour rehearsal day, and then you go to the theater and fundraise at night, and you get up and write a grant at 8 in the morning, and that's what it is.
Carrie Perloff, about a year ago, I spoke with Tony Taccone of Berkeley Rep. I was trying to get a sense of the difference between your goals and mandates and theirs. And what he said to me is he said that it was his feeling that maybe it's because it's a smaller theater, that his audience, the Berkeley audience, was a bit more forgiving than the San Francisco audience, and therefore, to some degree, you were a little bit more limited in the scope of what you could attempt, I guess, from an experimental point of view. Do you think that's true?
I think the best thing about producing here is the audience. We've done outrageous, strange, like The Black Rider or The Overcoat or this piece we're building next year called The Tosca Project, which is a sort of a movement theater collaboration with the ballet. The audience has always gone with it amazingly. I mean, I think we're very different theaters. ACT is a very actor-driven theater, which it always has been. You know, it has a core company. We are one of the only theaters in America that actually puts actors in the center of it, pays them 52 weeks of the year, and gives them a big role in shaping the season. Dramatic literature is incredibly important to us. We're a much more classical theater. I really believe in the canon. I don't believe in doing new plays if they're not sitting next to classical plays. I think that's how, for me anyway, that's how it works, most interestingly. But that's just taste. I mean, I think it's fantastic that we're all here in the Bay Area doing such different things because we all have very different taste and very different agendas, and it makes for a more fertile ecosystem, you know?
When you talk about doing the canon, why do you feel that that's so important? I mean, I'm not...
No, it's a good question. Because I think most contemporary writing is really thin. You know, most playwrights today have only ever watched episodes of Seinfeld. And to me, what the theater can do is so much richer than that. But if you've never seen a Brecht play, or you've never read Euripides, or you've never encountered Shakespeare or the Jacobeans or whoever it is that fuels your imagination, you will probably tend to write television plays because that's what you see. So I love the RSC model, which they developed in the 80s, which is you commission someone like, you know, David Edgar or Timberlake Orton Baker to write a play, and then you put it next to Henry V. That, you know, that to me is really thrilling when that can happen.
A few weeks ago, I went to a production, MFA production, that ACT put on of...
Philistines. Did you see
Philistines,
that? Good for you.
And even though, you know, the play itself doesn't quite hold up as well as you like, the idea of seeing a Gorky play, seeing that itself, was stunning for me. I mean, it was a great experience.
And also what you realize is these questions that Gorky was wrestling with in 1907, right, about generational change and the need for revolution and the disillusionment of the young with their parents, obviously is not a new theme. And for our students, our 20-something students, to realize the legacy, the history of those questions and how Gorky framed it was very resonant for them. And that's why when we train, they do an enormous amount of classical work, and then they also do new plays.
Along with that, there's also Volley Girls at Zeum, which brings up the question, are you beginning to use Zeum a whole lot more, or has this been continual?
It's a good question. Yes, we are beginning to use it a lot more. And one of the things I'm most interested in is finding a way for both our MFA students and our young conservatory students to be more visible in the community. I think it's really important that there are lots of ways to experience theater. One way at ACT is to come to our beautiful main stage, Gilded House. But another way is to come listen to our young conservatory students sing a cabaret in the garret, or to go and see our MFA students do a new play at Zeum. And different people get excited about different ways to experience it, but it's all ACT. So that play, Volley Girls, was a fusion of a lot of things. It's our new work program that commissions new plays. It's our young conservatory in collaboration with the MFA, and that's been incredibly fun. And the audience is so mixed. It's teenagers and older people, and, you know, that's been fascinating, and that theater's very accessible.
when you're looking at a season in the future, you're also kind of looking at the past. So looking back, what do you think worked best about the past season, and what do you think maybe didn't?
Probably at the top of the list of what worked, rock and roll. You know, Tom Stoppard is enormously important to us and to our audience. It's sort of the most incredible contemporary writing that there is. Great muscle, great ideas, great passion, great music. It was a great outing for our core company. It was hugely successful, you know, at the box office. It was beautifully designed, and then it had a great run in Boston. So we had a wonderful time with that. And to me, that was sort of quintessential ACT. So I would say next to that, although I thought it was a beautiful play, I had maybe less strong feelings about quality of life, just in the sense that I felt we had less to bring to the table on that particular play. And I always try to think, what is it ACT can contribute that perhaps other theaters can't?
What about the John Guare play?
Well, it's very funny you'd ask. People either adored it or loathed it. And sometimes it's kind of great when that happens because people have really strong feelings. I love Guare, and I have to say that rehearsing that play was one of the happiest times we've had at ACT. He is the most generous, funny, anarchic, imaginative, crazy guy. And it was an absolutely insane, larger-than-life outing of a very young playwright because he did, you know, it's a play he wrote when he was very young. So I could see that people thought it was very green in some ways and very over the top. And on the other hand, I found it really moving. And I loved that company. I loved seeing what Gregory, our core company member, could do. And I loved the guest artists. They, unlike in some ways other productions where actors have come in, brought a lot to ACT. And I know that's hard sometimes for an audience to see, that there are pros and cons to that.
How did you manage to snag Souvenir? I mean, there's a Broadway show.
Judy Kay. You know, one of the things you try to do as an artistic director is find the artists that you fall in love with and take them to lunch. You just do everything you can to say to somebody, when Judy came here to do Sweeney Todd, not only was her performance extraordinary, she came and taught an MFA class in the school. She came and talked to our donors. And I thought, this is a woman who is a consummate theater woman and totally connected to what we're doing. And I took her to lunch and said, what else would you like to do? And she said, I have this piece that I'm dying to do at your theater. And I said, why here? And she said, because of your audience and because it's an opera town. They will know who Florence Foster Jenkins was, and they will know what this music is meant to sound like. It's also a gay town, and she thought it would be a really wonderful play for the gay community. And I said, great. So that's how it happened.
Sweeney Todd also came through, and that was again on a tour. How'd you manage to snag that one?
A combination of things. With Sweeney, we had started the tour of Urinetown, got to know those artists very well, and we've now worked with John Rando. That's how we met John Rando, Urinetown, who came back and directed Rich and Famous, and John Carafa, who's choreographing our gala. So same thing happened with Sweeney. Two major things came out of Sweeney. One was that in the original company of Sweeney was this extraordinary actor, Manuel Feliciano, who's from the Bay Area, who then came and did rock and roll and who's coming to join our core company next year. So that's really thrilling. Bay Area boy. And the other is we met John Doyle. And John Doyle is a prince like you cannot imagine. And took one look at our school and our core company and said, I want to come back next year and build a piece for you. So that's how it happens. You know, one relationship leads to another. And sometimes someone comes and you think, may I never see this artist again? And then that happens too, you know.
Well, what happens if you walk in and nothing is working? At what point can you just say, we're not going to do it? Or do you grit your teeth? I mean, how does that work? Because,
really,
I mean, that's the
question.
Thing about live theater.
Exactly.
You never know.
And the alchemy is very particular, and sometimes it doesn't catch fire right away. When it's a piece you've commissioned, like War Music, we did a series of workshops. And at every workshop, we said to Lillian, we could pull the trigger at the end of this or not. So we tried to be very honest with each other and with her to say, do we actually think this is going to be a viable piece of theater? And there are projects that we've looked at each other and said, you know what? No. We had done a version with David Gordon of Wind in the Willows, and we did a workshop, and two workshops, and we looked at each other finally and said, you know what? We love David, but this is not working. We're not going to do this. Sometimes we haven't pulled the trigger where we should have, or sometimes we've delayed it a year, like with Gorky's A Mother, with that translation, with Olympia. We said, we're not ready to do it. We'll do it in a year's time, and we've done that. You make the best educated guess you can, and that has to do with your years in the theater of trying to be able to predict the gap between, you know, the work in the room in a workshop and where it could go ultimately in production.
When you're doing a workshop, do you have an audience?
Yeah, We try to invite our board. We do a thing at ZM called First Look. Tosca is a beautiful example of that. So we can leap to the end of the season for a minute. We have been developing for 3 years a movement theater piece set in Jeanette Etheridge's bar in North Beach, the Tosca Cafe. I've been developing it with a choreographer from San Francisco Ballet called Val Cannaparoli, with whom we've collaborated a lot. He did our new Christmas Carol. He did Doll's House for us. He did Tis Pity for us. Originally, we did it as an experiment where we wanted to put five dancers and five actors in a room and see what would happen. When we did the first 20 minutes of material, we did it at ZM for the public. And what was amazing is the reaction. People said, you have to keep going, you have to keep going. Then we did it at Yerba Buena in a much bigger venue, 350 people for four performances. Our whole board, all our donors, anybody who sort of is a stakeholder at ACT came to see it, to weigh in. And at that point, we again decided to keep going. And now we're going to do another workshop this May, and then we'll do it next May. So, yes, it's really important to be transparent at a certain point. At the same time, you have to protect the artist.
How many plays are in that transition point now?
Usually we have one or two translations and one or two larger projects that are in the pipeline right now.
So there's like around four.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to an interview with Carrie Perloff, the artistic director of ACT, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. Let's talk about the upcoming season. At what point do you decide, do you start, or do you just kind of have a list and go, okay, 2009, 2010, what are we going to do? How do you originally get together so that you eventually narrow it down to the eight?
We have an artistic team meeting every week. And that includes our core company of artists and our dramaturg and our casting director, our conservatory director. We all meet together and, on the one hand, always have projects in the pipeline that we're interested in, that are being developed. And then other things come up because of the zeitgeist of the time. The moment we started last summer talking about this season, we knew it wasn't going to be business as usual on every level. You know, the economy was already in big trouble. We had no idea it was going to get as bad as this. The flip side is it's politically the most extraordinary moment that we have faced in a long time. So while we were in Boston with the core company, we would go out to dinner and have these discussions about what does this Obama election mean? And how are we going to be relevant as a theater and as artists and as citizens in this community to that event? So, for example, this is going to be a moment where America, we hope, is perceived very differently in the world. So it seemed important to me this season not just to do American work. You know, I think we're way too xenophobic in this country. We're only interested in new American plays or whatever. I think it's really important that we pick our heads up and we look internationally and say we are citizens of a bigger world. This is San Francisco. We're a very international community. What can we do?
And what was the result?
So we're doing a very first-time collaboration with the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada. I'm a huge fan of Canadian theater. The executive director at ACT, Heather Kitchen, is Canadian. We've had great experiences with things like The Overcoat, Two Pianos, Four Hands, with Canadian artists. And yet I think Americans are really arrogant about Canada. We don't realize what a great artistic community that is. So we're doing two Canadian projects next year. I'm going up to Stratford this summer and going to create this new production of Racine's very sexy, erotic play, Phèdre, in a new translation by Timberlake Wharton Baker that we commissioned, doing it with their company, headlined by this astonishing actress called Shauna McKenna. We did a workshop of it with her there last year. And then bring that company to San Francisco, and it'll be the first outing that that company has had on the West Coast ever, which is thrilling. And I think our audiences will be very excited about that. We're doing another Canadian play later in the season by Morris Panitch called Vigil, which has been a huge success in Vancouver and Toronto and all across Canada, has almost never been seen in the States. It's a very funny two-hander for Marco Baricelli and Olympia. And the last time they were together on stage was a French-Canadian play at ACT called For the Pleasure of Seeing Her Again. So I love that thread, and I love it that Morris Panitch, who did The Overcoat for us, is coming back, another artist whom I really admire, to write and direct this particular play.
The season opens with Noel Coward's Brief Encounter. Now, that's an import, right?
And that is another international collaboration. So this is an English company called the Knee High Theatre Company, which is based in Cornwall. And they're an experimental theater company led by a woman called Emma Rice, who does multidisciplinary sort of fusion kinds of pieces based on literature. So this is the play of Brief Encounter and the film of Brief Encounter and a lot of Noel Coward songs woven together in this multimedia, really imaginative, very moving play, one of the most heartbreaking love stories about adultery ever written.
Reminds me a little of the stuff that Theatre de June Lune did over at Berkeley
right,
Rep.
Right.
There's a Mammoth in there, too, November.
Oh, yes.
That was on Broadway, right?
That was on Broadway. And, you know, Mammoth is one of our most favorite writers because his language just pierces our proscenium like nothing you've ever seen. And our company is particularly adept at it. It's a very political play about a sort of George Bush-like president in the waning days of his presidency trying to figure out, now that he's screwed everything up, how he can have a legacy. It takes place over Thanksgiving, so the turkeys are supposed to be pardoned at that time. But it revolves around a lesbian scriptwriter who has just gone to China with her lover to adopt a baby, has come back with the flu and is therefore infecting the turkeys in the outer office. And in order to agree to write his concession speech, she tries to convince the president to let her marry her girlfriend on national television. So this seemed like a very resonant play to do at this moment.
Was there any problem in thinking on that one there might be a tour that would keep you from doing it? Or I mean, how does that stuff work?
We have a great relationship with Mammoth. He loves ACT. He did the Voisey Inheritance for us. He's made a lot of money off ACT in the past, and he knows we do it well. And frankly, we're represented by the same agent, so that sort of helps. So, you know, I called my agent, who's his agent, and said, is there any shot that we could get it, or is it going to go on the road? And he said, I don't know yet, but I'll put the oar in and see what happens. So sometimes you get lucky and sometimes you don't.
Is there a competition thing with, say, the Shorenstein people?
Oh, yeah, always. Depends on what the priorities of the artists are and where they feel most comfortable being and who has the relationship with them.
A lot of people can't really afford theater. What does ACT do to ensure that people can actually go?
Can go, it's a great question. We're doing a really exciting initiative that will sort of roll out, so watch for it here, with our second balcony to make it cheaper than going to a movie, basically, and really make that a kind of absolutely all-inclusive, general admission, go-for-it experience.
Really?
So that's one thing. I've learned a lot. I have two teenage children, so they are my guinea pigs. So I'm always saying to them, what would make you go to the theater, and why don't you go, and why, you know, and what would make it happen? And my daughter's at Harvard, and they don't even go, the Harvard students, to ART, which is the theater in Cambridge. And I keep saying, what is the matter with you guys? What would make you go? And I learned a bunch of things from them that is not news to anybody. You know, one is that teens and 20-somethings decide at 7:30 what they're going to do at 8, and it's all viral, so forget advance sales. But the other thing is that they always travel in packs, and they like general admission because they don't want to have to know whether there are 4 of them or 8 of them coming and they want to sit together. So I thought, well, that's a good aha. We should remember that, for example. Figure out a way that if they want to, they can sit together. People like to bring their drinks in. We are allowing that now, you know. We're really holding our prices down, even in our orchestra. We do big educator discounts because we really want teachers there. We're doing more student matinees. We just had the biggest success. We do this thing called Will on Wheels, where our second-year students do free Shakespeare in the schools all over the place, and we've had the biggest reach that we've ever had in the public schools now. So we're just trying to figure out all the different ways that we can get out there.
And how many people are in the MFA program now?
It traditionally been a program that has 14 students a year, and it's a 3-year MFA. And next year, we're shifting to what we call the MFA 8. So it's a much more exclusive, smaller class. And the goal of that is twofold. One is to graduate them with much less debt so they can stay and have a career in the theater and they don't have to immediately go do commercials, although, you know, that's good too. And the other is to integrate them more into our main stage work. So
I noticed that Christmas Carol, which plays every year, has a lot of people from the MFA. Is
I
that kind of the point?
That is. I created Christmas Carol to feature all our MFA students and 17 young conservatory students so that it would be the quintessential multi-generational show. So there have been years you've had Ken Ruta, 70-something Ken Ruta, who helped found this company, all the way down to, you know, 8-year-olds.
There's one play we didn't discuss, which is Round and Round the Garden by Alan Ayckbourn
right.
from the Norman Conquest. Why choose that play?
Because, you know, Norman Conquest, Alan Ayckbourn wrote for a company, and it's one of the great actor trilogies ever written. It's 3 plays, really. I love plays written for companies of actors because they're always really inventive, and it's great when you have a core company. Of course, we'd love to do all 3 of them, but we chose the one we love the most, which sits on our company beautifully. And I wanted a kind of sort of delicious, completely human love play about middle-aged people filled with longing, trying to sort of shift their lives and knowing that they were slightly stuck. And Acorn is brilliant at that. And so this is the third of that trilogy, and maybe if it goes well and it's really fun, at some point we'll do the other two and we'll put them all together.
There's also the Caucasian Chalk Circle
and
by
that
Breck.
Is our,
that's the John Doyle
that's
one.
That's our next outing with Doyle. So he said to me, I want to come to ACT and I want to create a piece for you all, knowing also that Mano Falciano was going to be here, who will play Aztec and around whom he can build the music, and he loves Mano. But he met our company and adored them, and we talked about what play, and he wanted to do a play that was very political, that was about political turmoil and political shift, but also about hope and change and the justice system. And he finally called me one day and said, we should do Caucasian Chalk Circle. And it's a new translation. It's going to have a completely original score. He's designing it himself, as he did with Sweeney. And I think that'll be really exciting.
What do you think is the connection between ACT and Brecht? I mean, the earlier productions, Happy End and Three Penny Opera,
mm-hmm.
were fantastic. Do you think it's because it's San Francisco, or what do you think that is?
Because my mother's Viennese, and I was raised on this material.
Really?
And when we did Happy End, I did it really to honor my mother, and she came to see it and said, well, it was wonderful, but it would have been better in German. Yeah, I think Brecht is a kind of a sophisticated political writer that somehow rings true to people in the Bay Area. This is not a community that is weaned on narrative realism. So Beckett does well here, too. Pinter does well here. New forms, other kinds of storytelling, Gogol, Gorky, are very popular here, and Brecht kind of fits into that tradition.
Carrie Perloff, let's talk a little about your own career. You said you started as an archaeologist and suddenly switched to theater in college. Is that what happened?
I had done a lot of theater when I was young. I actually did a lot of dance for years and years. I'm a huge dance nut and did ballet for years, so that's why I wanted to make a piece with the ballet. I went to Stanford to be an archaeologist and did ancient Greek, and my first year we staged Greek tragedies in Greek at Frost Amphitheater. And I think that doing Greek tragedy first has always informed how I see the theater, which is I'm not a realist. I'm not particularly interested in American realism. I'm interested in theater like Greek tragedy that uses everything, that uses music and movement and metaphor and poetic language and is for the polis, you know, the city-state. So I've always loved that. I discovered I wasn't nearly scientific enough to be a successful archaeologist. I fell in love with a guy in the drama department, you know, truth be told. And one thing led to another. I went to Oxford on a Fulbright and just started directing there and met great theater people and met a lot of writers and started doing plays and went to New York and...
Well, what happened? How'd you get in the gig in New York?
God, I have no idea. I had no ambition to run a theater. But I was a woman who wanted to do big, meaty plays. I didn't want to do sort of the mother-daughter plays, you know. And that's really tough, particularly when you're young and you look young and you didn't go to graduate school. And, I mean, I had nothing going for me, you know. So I was just sort of willing to do crazy stuff. And I ended up directing a play at CSC when that theater was utterly bankrupt. And the artistic director abandoned it. They hadn't paid their payroll taxes. The whole theater was boarded up. And they said, oh, and would you like to be the artistic director? And I was 27. I had no idea what I was doing. My first task was to hire the fattest actor I knew to sit on the Con Ed grate so they couldn't read our meter because we hadn't paid them Con Ed bill in 6 months. And my second task was to learn tax law because the guy hadn't paid payroll taxes in a year and we were in foreclosure. I mean, it was unbelievable. But, you know, when you're 27, you think, okay, what the hell? So I just made it up as I went along and I learned how to run a theater that way. And I ran CSC for 7 years.
Do you think that that was the reason that you were able to do that, that the people at ACT said, well, if she could do that, she could come here and get us out of debt?
Partly, I think I was a very maverick hire for ACT. I mean, nobody, it was ridiculous. I was 32. I had a baby. You know, they never had hired a woman at ACT, let alone a woman director. I mean, it was nuts. But I think they really realized that it couldn't be business as usual. This theater was in huge, epic trouble. It is amazing after the earthquake it didn't close.
What happened? I mean, it started in 65, came to San Francisco, achieved some kind of success under William Ball.
Immensely successful, incredible company of actors, visionary direction by Bill Ball. Then Bill Ball started to sort of fall apart, made a lot of very bad financial decisions, embezzled a lot of money, got in big legal trouble, was forced to abdicate, left the company very shaken. There was no succession plan, which is what happens often when you have a founder. There was no infrastructure. There was no management. There'd never been a managing director. There wasn't a development wing. There wasn't anything like that. It had been one man's vision. Ed Hastings did a brilliant job trying to put it all back together. Then came the earthquake. So once the building had tumbled down and the school was fallen apart and there was no fundraising mechanism, it was really at ground zero and had to be either abandoned completely, and people talked about should it just go, or put back together. So although we're a 42-3-year-old theater, I think of ourselves as really a very young theater.
You're also a playwright. Your most recent one that's I guess, in workshop, is it? Is Luminescent Dating? What story behind that?
It was produced at the Magic. My first play was called The Colossus of Rhodes, which was produced in New York, commissioned by Lucille Ortel many years ago. And then we did at Zeum as the beginning of our New Works program at Zeum. And then I wrote a play about archaeology called Luminescence Dating, which was commissioned by Ensemble Studio Theater in New York and premiered in New York. And then Chris Smith produced it at the Magic.
Do you like writing more than directing? Do you direct your own work? How does that
I
work?
I don't
for
direct
you?
My own work, and I love having other people do my work. I love the collaboration. I love. I've actually been working with Tony Ticone on a new play of mine called Hire, which is about architects, and we've had a great time. I'm a much more experienced director than writer, although the irony is I started my career as a playwright. One of the first experiences I had at CSC when I was in my 20s was working with Harold Pinter, whom I was in absolute awe of from the get-go. And so I have to say at that moment I thought, when there is a Harold Pinter in the world, why am I contributing to the mediocre store of plays? You know, when there's Pinter, so I stopped writing, and then I came back to it, and now I've had a fantastic time. It gives you a chance to tell your own stories after many, many years of telling other people's stories. It's a chance to refertilize myself. This is a job that absolutely sucks you dry. Everybody wants a piece of you. You have to help everybody else realize their visions, but nobody's really there in that way for you. So being able to write my own work is a way to really replenish myself and check in with myself about what I'm actually thinking. Because when you write, it's completely unconscious, and you don't know what you're thinking until you write it.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, too, that you had one play at the Magic and you're collaborating with Tony Ticone on another, which means that the collegial work of Bay Area theater is tighter than people think.
Very much so. I loved working with Chris. I love working with Loretta. I've loved working with Tony. Our student, Ryan Rillette, is now one of the, you know, directors, the managing director of Marin Theater Company. So there's a real connection there. Lisa Steindler, who runs Encore, graduated from ACT. We work really closely with her. We work closely with Sean San Jose. I'm a big fan of Intersection. You know, writers like Philip Gotanda cross lines a lot. And I think it's very collegial, not just with the theaters. I'm working with the Jewish Museum right now with Connie Wolf. We're working with San Francisco Ballet. I think particularly in this terrible moment, the Bay Area will survive because we actually will figure out how to collaborate with each other.
In terms of becoming a performer or an actor, what should someone do?
www.act-sf.org, and you click on our conservatory link, and you go to Studio ACT. And Studio ACT is our weekend and evening program, and it's an amazing program taught by professional actors, and you can enter at any level. You can do a voiceover class if you want to be a broadcaster. You can do a first-year acting class. You can do an improv class. You can do musical theater. You can do singing. You can do playwriting. And you find out. And then if you're serious, the next step at ACT would be to apply to our Summer Training Congress, which is an intensive summer, 5-week, or there's a 2-week program where you just do theater, do acting all day, voice, speech, movement, text, everything, and see. And then you go on from there, and if you're really serious, then you think about really getting graduate training.
Your first year, 1992, what happened with Duchess of Malfi?
Fabulous, epic disaster. And, you know, I wish I'd made T-shirts that said, I survived the Duchess of Malfi. The Duchess of Malfi, you will be amused to know, was my gift to the Bay Area, I thought, because I was trying to think who are the artists who've meant something to people here whom I can include in my season, like Dario Fo. That was also a debacle, but I tried. And Robert Woodruff, who, you know, ran Padua Hills and the Bay Area Playwrights Festival and the Magic Theater, did all those memorable, brilliant Shepherd plays, and I thought, great, we'll have Woodruff. And there was Woodruff in his Camille Paglia phase doing the Duchess of Malfi. And, you know, one of the things about Woodruff is 5 weeks of rehearsal only gets you to act one. He needs 5 months. And so it was completely unfinished and under-rehearsed. It had moments of absolute brilliance that I will never forget. Randy Danson gave a performance that was memorable. But it also had completely scandalous, gratuitous things. And mainly, now no one would blink an eye. If we did it now, it's like what our Edward II, the naked Edward II, people just ate it up. But then nobody knew me. And here was this chick who came from New York and suddenly is doing this outrageous thing, and people thought, every play we did was going to look like the Duchess of Malfi, so they were rather hysterical. And the person who saved me was my beloved Dean Alan Jones from Grace Cathedral, which is why I always have revered him, because he came down the hill and said, you know, you can hate this play, but you cannot close it down.
And then you did the Dario Fo.
Oh, yes.
And got picketed.
We got picketed, but I was redeemed when he won the Nobel Prize.
You know, looking over the years, can you think of any other thing that was completely insane like that? Or was that just the start, and after that it became easier?
That was about the most insane. And it was partly because they didn't know me, and ACT is such a big theater that they took everything we did as being gospel for what ACT was going to be. And it was a nightmare. I've never felt so beleaguered and beaten up in my life, but in the long run it was probably the best thing we could do, just to sort of announce once and for all, this is not your father's ACT. Here we go. We're starting over. You know, there were people who complained about non-traditional casting, and this was the Bay Area.
Right.
When we did an Uncle Vanya with an African-American astro, I got hate mail, and I thought, are you kidding me? In San Francisco? And that's all changed now, completely.
There was a production several years ago, about 13 years ago, called High Society.
Mm-hmm.
It got rave reviews. I went to see it, and I went, this is interesting. This will never make it in New York. And they took it to New York, and it bombed in New York. And afterward, I spoke with somebody in the theater, somebody who worked at the Geary, I think it was, I'm not going to say who was, who said that a lot of people tried to talk the producers out of going to New York, but they were unbowed because it had made so much money here. What's the story behind that?
I think it was way too sophisticated a sort of confection for what they expected it to do in New York. Do you know what I mean? I mean, in other words, they had expectations that it was going to sell the way, you know, Mamma Mia sold, but it was basically Philadelphia Story, which is a wonderful but very sophisticated piece of writing, Philip Barry. It's not Mamma Mia. It's not Hairspray. And then I think they really kind of made the wrong decisions when it went to New York in trying to move it in that direction. I think they vulgarized it in some ways, tried to make it a much bigger production. It was very spare here and very elegant, and they fired all the designers and started again, and you know how that goes. It didn't matter to us. It was a beautiful piece that was very successful here. And to us, what's most important for us is how does it work here? This is the audience.
Carrie Perloff, moving on past 2009 to 2010, what kind of things do you have in mind?
I'd love to continue this trend that we're looking at of creating multidisciplinary work. So we've commissioned Ping Chong, who's an incredible artist, to make a new piece for us, and I think that will also be, you know, movement and maybe film and theater. I'm talking to Meredith Monk. I love the Geary being a home for artists like Madigan Shive, that great cellist who did the music for 'Tis Pity. I am determined that we're still going to do these kind of really amazing reimaginings of big classical plays, but the funding for that is very, very difficult to come by. I'm hoping we'll grow our core company, whom I adore, and I'm hoping we'll do more second stage work again.
Well, I found a 2001 article about Carrie Perloff's plans for 2001. There were three. One, building an acting company.
And we did it.
Okay. Two, the second stage.
Which we've done.
Yeah, well, when you're talking about a second stage, what about, like, Berkeley Rep has a permanent second stage.
Mm-hmm.
And what about you?
We haven't ever. And it's something, you know, I remember when Tom Stoppard first came to work with us, he said, but where is your Cottesloe? You know, like, where's your... And ACT never had a studio theater. So ZM has come as close as we could. And we've done a lot of programming in there. And I hope, you know, as things go on, we'll be able to expand that.
And the third thing was developing new scripts and translations,
uh-huh,
which you've been working on.
A lot of, yeah.
So what grade do you give yourself over the past 8 years?
What grade?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I feel incredibly proud of the work. I really believe that theater should be artist-driven. I'm incredibly proud that we're just about the only theater in America that has kept actors, major actors, on salary year-round. I'm incredibly proud of the actors that we've trained. I'm incredibly proud of people like Marco, who was in our company and then went on to run his own company and took what he learned at ACT and ran with it. Those things are really rewarding.
Carrie Perloff, next season, which of those are you directing?
I'm directing Phaedra, and I'm directing and creating Tosca.
In terms of writing, you're working on more plays?
Oh, yeah. I have two new plays I'm working on. One is I'm finishing the architecture one, and one is a play called Waiting for the Flood, which is seven women, and it's sort of loosely a play about my female ancestors. It's set in the 40s.
War music, just opening and runs through April 26th.
That's right.
And after that, this season, one more play, which is...
Two more plays. I'm directing Boleros for the Disenchanted, which is Jose Rivera's very gorgeous, lush love story set in Puerto Rico. And then we're doing Edward Albee's At Home at the Zoo, which is a real exciting moment.
Is that the two plays put together as one that was on Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to an interview with Carrie Perloff, who's artistic director of ACT, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.